Hi, Richard. Hi, Kira.
Late.
Hi, Derek.
For a hot second there, I thought I was maybe me and Stephen were at the wrong location. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, y'all, how's it going?
No, it should be the right one. We'll
Great.
just give everyone a couple minutes.
Thanks for the report, Stephen. I was just going through it. It's really interesting, actually, this month.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on. Thanks for reading it. That doesn't always happen either. I know it. Y'all can't fool me. It's a lot to slog through, and a lot of it is, similar from month to month, so.
Right.
Hey, David.
Hello. Hey, Dave. How's it going, Derek?
Hang in there. Markster. So waiting a few more moments for folks to come in.
Dave and Kira, I just sent you both the attachment that I'll be going over during the carry forward discussion in case I have a problem sharing screen, as I seem to occasionally have. You have it there. Hopefully you can jump in. Oh, good. I was just about to text you, Bill. Looks like I don't need to.
Hi.
Hi. Ooh, this looks like about the opposite of quorum when there are only the co-chairs. Kira, who is missing? Sorry to be a busybody.
We are
No,
missing David Gonzalez. He said he would probably be joining community engagement. So I'm counting him, but maybe not. David Gonzalez, Lee Jewell, and Laura Thomas.
everyone else is excused. There must be an everyone else. Let me open up my own roster. So no Laura? Is Laura excused?
No. Laura's not excused.
How about Juba?
Juba is.
Oh, okay, great. So that means we're just missing, as you mentioned, Lee as well as Laura. How about TJ?
No TJ on here.
Okay. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, Ben's no longer here, so that's 6. Wow, this has turned into a very intimate gathering. Of 6 people minus, so that means for quorum, you'd need 4. Because there's no excuse as far as, I mean, no leave of absence as far as I know for these 6 folks. So yeah, you'll need 2 more people. And there's a vote here as well that is for carry forward. So if you, I mean, you could still, I guess, do a recommendation, which would go to the next committee. So I guess it doesn't mean we don't have to have the conversation. But yeah, it would be literally being recommended by 2 people, two council members, because I assume Bill would abstain on this one. This doesn't interfere with the other agenda items, right? Because HCAT can still happen, and certainly can any discussion around needs assessment. But I guess I'm just trying to figure out my agenda item, which is the reason why I'm here, which is a carry forward. If it should continue, if there's not quorum, what do you all think? I mean, it's a vote on money, so.
So it's not listed as a vote, and when I looked at it, I kind of thought that was unusual, but I would suggest that it's postponed. Like, I would be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't know about postponed. I think just removed, and then so that it'll now first appear at the next committee meeting. So because if it wasn't noticed as a vote, you couldn't vote on it anyway. And I think the next one is council affairs. Sorry, Bill. I know that you're in another meeting, but it looks like this won't be the meeting where the scenarios debut at. It'll have to be. I forget which is next, council affairs or is it membership? Let me check my calendar.
Council affairs.
That's fine with me, Mark. As long as a group, if it doesn't go through one committee for vote, and you guys could still vote in July. Also, if there's anyone wanting clarification, I think it could be a discussion if that's of interest to the 2 members or others here. I'm happy to hang around if folks want to do that. Your guys' call.
So another suggestion here. I'll take responsibility for not listing it as a vote. That was my fault. I just didn't make it in there for some reason when adding the agenda item. But presumably Richard and Derek are both members of the PLWH work group. I don't know if either of you are planning on attending the PLWH work group that is scheduled for, I believe, the 17th of this month. These recommendations will be reviewed there as well. So you both will have an opportunity to get another bite of the apple if you are interested. So if Bill doesn't want to have the conversation now for the sake of time, maybe you guys can just take part in that conversation then. And you'll be able to vote on it at that point.
Dave, I just have one question. You said the 17th of July?
I believe it's the 17th. Let me double check my calendar.
That's a Sunday.
Sorry, it's the Tuesday before steering, which
it's
is...
It's the
19th. Okay, because I don't think we have someone from HIV Health Services coming to that meeting, although we could if you guys would like. We're really here to provide information. We're not necessary, but if folks want to understand how we came to it or that stuff.
Oh yeah, because in the past, we certainly have had Kevin, pre-pandemic, be there. But so yeah, if someone could, it seems strange to have a conversation when it's gonna with 2 people who will be in a meeting where the conversation will happen again, you know.
Richard, what time is the meeting?
3:00. Yes.
Yes, I could make that. Could someone send me? Never mind. I'll make myself a note. Sorry for the pounding. Some construction next door.
We'll also
Richard, you have a question.
So we're Dave, we're going to receive a email and a link reminding us of that. I haven't seen anything yet.
An announcement will go out 72 hours in advance of the meeting, the same as all committees.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Okay. Well, then, since the meeting hasn't officially started, I'm going to leave it, since it doesn't seem like my agenda item is going to. So you'll just all pull that from the agenda when you do agenda approval. All right. Yes. Adios. Nice seeing you, Stephen.
Always. You too.
So, you know, Beth is off this week, kind of well-earned break. So I'll hang for a little bit, at least for Stephen's presentation. And if you guys have any other questions about HHS-related stuff, just let me know and I'll hang longer.
Thanks so much, Bill. So with that, let's get started. Sorry for the late start, of course. We'll look at reviewing and approving the draft agenda. As we just spoke about, taking off the carry forward allocation vote from the agenda item has been put forward. I don't know if anybody would disapprove of that, so I'm going to take that as a silence as an assent as a change from the agenda. And let's look at the minutes from last month.
One moment. Where are you? That's not it. There we go.
Were there any changes from the last month's minute that people may have, Richard? So, with silence, I will take that as an approval for the minutes. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, guys. Sorry. So we did not do, sorry about this, but we really didn't do the introduction. And I don't know whether, let's still do that. I'm sorry, guys, if I messed that up. So my name is Derek Mapp. I'm co-chair for this subcommittee. And if you could bounce it to the next, Kira.
Hi everyone, I'm Kira, council staff. Okay. And then I'll do David.
David Jordan, council staff. Stephen.
Stephen Spano, the HCAP staff attorney at AORP. I'll bounce it to Richard.
Hi, everyone. Richard Sullivan, co-chair, community engagement. Bill Bloom.
Hi, I'm Bill Bloom, HIV Health Services, as well as planning council member.
Thanks, guys, for that. Reverting back to our agenda, is there any public comments? Is there any comments or announcements that people might have? Okay. The show is yours, Stephen, the HIPCAP report.
Thank you. So as per the usual, I'll highlight some of the items that I think are most notable from the report this month. And then I'll open it up for any additional questions to expand on anything that folks would like to specifically talk about. On page one of the report, I'll direct you to HCAP number 2022-49. you know, this was upsetting for me and another attorney at the office who were supporting this client for a little while, but the client did, you know, request support in seeking mental health, additional mental health support, and was being supported by another attorney at AORP. And, you know, I tried to effectuate the referral to the extent that I was able, but prior to them being able to get through the intake process, they were found dead in their apartment. So the case is moot, but I thought it was worth noting because, you know, mental health support continues to be, you know, an area of need in the community. And to my knowledge, there's wait lists in excess of 4 and 5 months at the service providers that are receiving Ryan White Care funds. Most of our clients are eligible for non-Ryan White Care support as well, but those resources are similarly drained and similarly scarce. So it seems like the service providers out here in the community are really unable to meet the, you know, the urgency of the need in the community. I'll turn next to 2022-25. This is not a unique case for the report. This is on page 3. Sorry. It's not unique for the report. It's similar to many, I think at least 5 other cases on the report, because it regards housing services for a resident at an RCFCI who is transitioning into a, you know, a different living environment. But I'll just draw your attention to the one of the last sentences or second to last sentence, which is, you know, HCAP is informed that these efforts are not currently prioritized due to a staffing crisis within the service providers organization. This is yet another highlight to exactly where the need, I think, seems to be for housing navigation support. Right now, it's falling on the existing service providers, you know, oftentimes social workers or folks that are really in no position to be able to find housing, let alone secure it, to actually find housing and secure it. I wanted to highlight that just to, again, kind of share with you where I think the need is. And then I'll turn again to another case that I think is illustrative. I told the client that I would share this bit with them because they felt very kind of under-supported just by the processes that are available to them for grievances. But this is on page 6, and it's 2022-21. And this is a resident in a substance use facility. And I think we've talked about it. Anybody who's joined on some of the on some of the harm reduction discussions that DPH sponsors, you know, we've kind of talked about where some of the challenges exist within the harm, honoring the harm reduction model. And I think this is kind of, you know, exactly an example, one that I have shared before, but, you know, here the client came to me looking to file a grievance because they were feeling under-supported with regard to the cohabitation environment. And the service provider was kind of left without an ability to support and didn't really find a way to land with the client in a way that made them feel acknowledged. And so, you know, I thought it was important to highlight this sentence, and I told the client that I would highlight the sentence where their service provider responded that they investigated and was left feeling that there was, quote, quite a bit of nuance to the situation and did not believe it would be appropriate or productive to address with the client. The client was kind of simultaneously going through the grievance process through the behavioral health network that exists in the city. That's not something I typically support on, not something I wouldn't support on if I had the capacity, but I didn't in this instance. But they went through that and basically received a letter saying your grievance has been resolved, but nobody ever actually spoke with them. They just sent a letter saying it's been resolved. And you know, that seems to be a pretty typical outcome for a lot of folks. And I guess I just wanted to share this because, you know, oftentimes the grievance process, if I'm there and I'm and I can help, you know, work through and both parties are willing to come to a table to have a conversation, oftentimes the outcome is very different than this, where the client does feel acknowledged and the client does feel like they've been supported by the service provider, even if actually nothing was done. But, you know, in this instance where people weren't willing to come to the table, it kind of changes the dynamic a bit, and the client was left feeling, you know, under-supported. And I have no other information to share from the service provider's end because I was told that they just weren't willing to have a discussion beyond that. So with that, I'll kind of step off and I'll let, you know, questions come up.
I don't know if anyone has any questions for Stephen.
Okay.
Well, I'm actually sort of wondering, particularly for the client that was found in their apartment, is there an idea that the lack of response from the service provider is what left them wanting to commit suicide, or was it even suicide, I guess is the question.
So it's not clear. The best we were able to get from the housing provider was that it was likely an overdose. We have the last posted, you know, the last public post by the client was, it wasn't suicide ideation. It was seeking donations for an organization that supports suicide prevention. So, you know, clearly it was, you know, something the client was cognizant of. Whether that, you know, whether that's where she was coming from at the time, I don't know. I think it's likely another victim of overdose that, you know, we can unfortunately add to the statistic. But no, I wouldn't say that this was the fault or, you know, of any service provider. You know, it happens where clients come to us and, you know, we can provide a referral, we can give them information, we can tell them where to go for support. Every service provider has their process. And in this instance, I think this service provider's process is, you know, the first step can sometimes take a week to effectuate. You kind of make a phone call and then they get back to you. Or if you're lucky, you can kind of walk in. I did advise the client to walk in because I thought that was the quickest way to get connected. I am not informed as to whether they followed through on that or not. I have no way of finding out whether they did walk in and whether they sought support and was waiting for access or was in the middle of the process. I have no way of finding that out because the client in this instance didn't sign a release for me. They just kind of wanted me to reach out and get more about the intake process. And so I, you know, that was basically it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I unfortunately don't have more information about that. I will say in my outreach to the service provider, that's when I was told about a 5-month wait list. So unfortunately, even if that the client had connected, gone through the intake process and was, you know, enrolled, they likely would not have seen a therapist until the beginning of 2023, which I don't know if by then anything would have resolved, you know.
I have an additional question in regards to the clients that you did highlight, and that was the very last one. And it's a two-parter, actually. Thanks for that. And one of it has to do with just the idea of the grievance procedure. There seems to be, I seem to be aware that if the client isn't satisfied with the agency level of response, that they can take it to the Department of Health. Do you think that is potentially where this is headed? And the second part has much more to do with mediation, mediation services that the city provides. Would this be an example of something that those services would be able to support or not?
So I'll start by answering the first part of your question, which is the furthering of the grievance process beyond the agency level. To my knowledge, there are basically three recourses. Two of them are available in most instances. One of them is available to folks who are utilizing the substance use programs that exist in the city, and that's the Behavioral Health Network grievance process. It's an external process. HCAP doesn't really support on it. The other two are referrals to the Office of Civil Rights or a referral to the San Francisco, I can think of the attorney's name, but I can't think of the agency right now.
Are you thinking about HRC?
Yeah, sorry. Yes, the Human Rights Commission. Yeah, thank you, Bill. So those are basically the two outside referrals that I can make beyond the agency level grievance. There are further referrals, other grievance procedures that are available to clients who are accessing healthcare. And if it's primary healthcare, there are state level grievance procedures that you can follow through. It's the Office of Insurers. I forget the acronym, but it's basically the healthcare providers, insurance oversight committee or something like that. I have on occasion told clients, you know, that's your next step. If that's something you want to pursue. The problem is these grievance processes are not things that I can really have the capacity to support on. They're lengthy. They ultimately don't really result in a whole lot more than what I can do at the agency level. But if a client is activated or energized to the extent where they want to continue to be heard, what I'll often do is you'll have to do the paperwork. I'm happy to review it. And if it culminates in a meeting, I'm happy to attend with you. So you have support there. And that's, I kind of limit my support to them in those ways. I have on occasion, supported by forwarding documentation to HRC, if that's something that the client wants to do. I think in this case, and common in these cases, is it gets to a point of exasperation where the clients have just, you know, they feel like they've gone through all of the steps and they continue to just get like, you not really go anywhere with it. And it just becomes like kind of like, there's a sense of helplessness and exasperation with it, where it's like, why bother? Like, I've got so much other stuff going on in my life. And I don't know if you can call that acceptance or not, but if it is, then maybe that's a helpful place to get. I don't know. But in this instance, the client just was just, you know, that's what they communicated to me. And I said, well, you know, I do this report every month. This will appear on the report. If you would like, I'm happy to highlight it to the group so that they know that this is kind of an ongoing issue for folks that are going through these programs. And he felt supported by that, right? So the external grievance processes, I have very little to yeah, that is, I love the language, but yeah. It's certainly less than acceptance, but unfortunately, I think the grievance procedures through the Behavioral Health Network don't typically result in any sense of acknowledgement either. At least that's been the feedback that I've gotten. So that's hopefully that. I don't know if was that responsive to the first part of your question, Derek?
Sure. Yes.
The second part of your question was about mediation. And, you know, throughout this process, I continued to press for mediation. I typically do this in two ways. One, I try to help the clients understand how mediation can support. And you said that there was mediation provided through the city. I'm not aware of any city sponsored mediation. There is community. There are a couple of community organizations that provide mediations. Typically, they're free of charge or sliding scale or donation based. And I'm always happy to, you know, these are organizations that I've done trainings through. So the one way I do is I try to urge clients to engage those services individually. It is a voluntary process. And so in a situation where you're talking about cohabitation, both residents would need to consent to that. And unfortunately, when there's conflict of that nature, not always are both, you know, residents willing to engage, or one saying, well, if they do it, then I'll do it. Or why should I do that if they're not willing to, you know, and it winds up in a kind of an unfortunate stalemate. The second way I support is I have developed MOUs with the organizations that provide these trainings and these mediations. And I have, I wouldn't say without fail, but pretty consistently introduced the organizations to the service providers that I'm working with in hopes that they will engage the community, you know, the community providers for mediation to train their staff a little bit more about conflict resolution. You know, it is common for folks who are counselors in these programs to have gone through the programs. They may or may not be well-trained or well-versed in conflict resolution or mediation, but the trainings are available and they want to see that method of dispute resolution permeate throughout the community because it's just healthier for everybody. So they're always willing to provide trainings of varying levels. So I will often, as part of my services to the service providers, and I just kind of do it naturally, but I guess one could call it, you know, technical support. But I will introduce the organization to the mediators. And that's another way that I try to integrate mediation into the process. But those are kind of the only two tools that I have to do it. And both are voluntary on the parts of other people.
Thanks for the correction, Stephen, there. That's what I meant.
Yeah, for sure. I would love it if there were city city mediators.
Does anyone have any other questions in regard to the HICCAMP report? So, Ed, thanks a lot, Stephen. Great reporting as usual.
Thank you.
We'll move next to the needs assessment update, COLA update.
Yeah, so to begin with, I will just give you an update on these assessments. So we are in the midst of our outreach portion. We have a sort of semi-functional working list of suggested outreach partners, collaborative partners from this committee from a couple meetings ago. And we are working from that plus a couple other places. So we're reaching out to a number of different trans focused organizations. I did have sort of, aside from that, I also had a kind of apropos of nothing, had a colleague at Shanti reach out to me about doing some collaborative work with Ella, which is great because that, you know, that is one of their focuses. And so we're working on maybe getting something going there. We'll need to, we also need to get a translate our materials in Spanish, which we should just do as a matter of course, as opposed to sort of when needed. But we're still working on making that sort of part of the process. So along with that, I've been doing a little bit of work around putting together some survey instruments specifically for trans population, but I'm also kind of putting a lot of thought into how to potentially reinvent what we're doing here, find a better way to, as discussed in this committee previously, a better way to serve the needs of the council itself and what its goals are, with a recognition that, you know, quantitative data is not really what we do. We don't really have capacity to do a large scale quantitative data gathering effort because it's just two of us, one of us sometimes, who are working on this project. And our numbers generally are just under 100 or around 100. While not statistically insignificant, it's not, you know, it maybe is not quite enough broad sampling to really draw much in the way of conclusions from. And we also get reports from Epi section, we get reports from Aries, we get reports from, you know, you guys just got your report from John Ainsley around Aries data last month. And so what we do well is take the time to get a sort of depth of information, qualitative information from consumers of services. And to that end, I'm trying to figure out how to best capitalize on that. And I don't think just a straight ahead survey is what is going to get us that. Survey provides us a certain amount of demographic context. But so I'm just putting a little thought into what that looks like and how we approach it. And the flip side of that is what it looks like presentation wise. Because I'll be honest, and I said this before, I feel like the whole thing has gotten a little bit rote. Maybe it's just that I've been doing it for too long. I don't know. But it feels like people, the council members are less responsive than they were at one point. I'm trying to figure out how to sort of rekindle interest, and some of that may be through coming up with a more sort of engaging presentation, mode of presentation. So hopefully we will come up with something that works better for folks, not just you, but the full council, who are not necessarily privy to all of the lead up conversations about what our intentions are and the process. So that is where we are. Any questions about needs assessment before I move on to COLA?
No questions, just a comment. I appreciate your thoughts about engaging council members. I think this is something that would be worthwhile to put on the agenda and explore further.
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that, I mean, Lee, of the people who are here right now, you are probably the only one who will maybe remember it, because Derek was, though a council member, was a prevention council member, and Richard, this is probably before Richard's time, but there was a period where, you know, when we gave these presentations, I felt like there was an energy around sort of following through with the recommendations and the sort of community voice that was coming out of the needs assessment. There are motions made to move forward with funding particular strategies and interventions via HHS or otherwise that were coming from the council. It didn't feel like I was having to do quite as much leading. And these days, I feel like I give that presentation and people were like, okay, so great. Thanks, you know, thanks for doing that. And it does, you know, the demographic stuff, the quantitative stuff looks very similar year over year, depending on which population we're focusing on. And so I just would like to get to the back to that point. And, you know, I'll be honest, some of that I put on the merge. Once the merge happened, I think that our focus got a little diffused. There was, you know, a lot of prevention council members who kind of were like, what the hell is this we are even asking us to do? Maybe didn't even recognize that the intention was for them to make a motion based on our recommendations. And so I'm trying to get back there. Anyways, to that end, Cola, if you don't mind, I'm quickly going to open. Oh, go ahead, Stephen.
I'm sorry. I hope it's okay to ask a question, but you mentioned a merge. Are you talking about, was the council merged at some point? So I'm assuming there were two councils. There was a prevention council and a council for what's HIV services?
Care council. So they're both basically councils that are meant to administer funding streams. One is administering funding streams coming from HRSA, the Health Resource Services Administration, via HHS, and the other is administering CDC funding coming through CHEP. This was the two were merged forcibly, almost. There was definitely some growing pains, and interestingly, the two councils had sort of significantly different mandates and guidances in how they were to enact their what their responsibilities were and what their powers were. And so I think that caused a lot of confusion. And I think even this many years later, 5-6 years later, there is still a little bit of like struggling to figure out exactly how best to move forward. It is what it is.
Yeah, and the funding streams are important because prevention dollars through the CDC that come into the city, the prevention planning council is advisory and different than what our mandate is. So yeah, I'm happy to sit down with you sometime with Stephen and talk about it, just to kind of give you more background.
I appreciate that. Thank you for the context that you provided.
So I'm going to go ahead and share with you, after I've been talking all this shit about how quantitative data is not important, I'm going to quickly run through the survey that we did for the COLA focus group. I'm not going to belabor it, but you know, it's context. So that is, let's see, where are you hiding, my friends? Hold on, let me close this. There we go. Jump this back up to the top. So as you can see, this is based in long-term survivors. Everybody was over 55. Largely Caucasian, so one Latino, one multiracial. Interestingly, no African Americans, though I know that there was at least one African American there. one female, the balance were male. 9 total participants. It says 8, but clearly one person didn't fill out a survey. Everybody has living with HIV for more than 20 years. Most had been tested for Hep C. Some had access services. Here we thought it would be interesting to sort of look at like what kind of treatments were available, HIV treatments were available at the time of seroconversion. For most, it was AZT or none was also an option. So looks like one person having access to Hep C treatments as well and cleared the virus, which is great. We see a lot of folks having had challenges with substance use in this group, and also a number of them having access treatment. Couple having been previously incarcerated. Again, the larger percentage having experienced mental health challenges, either currently or in the past. And again, you know, most had access to some sort of mental health services. Whether that was effective for them or not is not clear in that graph, which is part of the challenge of these kind of things. Half and half around having sufficient information around services. And, you know, again, sort of split on trusted support. So that is it for the survey. I'm actually going to move over to where this. So this is a sort of one sheet. That's more than one sheet, but a brief sort of summary of what the COLA looked like, and sort of what its tone and what we covered. I'm attempting to avoid a lot of sort of wordy analysis here and try and put a lot more of the actual conversation on the page. So relying a little more heavily on quotes, which I feel kind of tell the story without having to put too much of my voice or any staff voice in there as sort of a filler. There are times where I felt like it was important to provide some synthesis or synopsize a bit, but you'll see a lot of this is going to be in quotes, which were direct quotes from the conversation.
So. Hey, David, could you enlarge it a little bit? It's a little bit hard to read.
Sure. Where? I hate working in this.
The bottom right. In the bottom right, I think you can, there's a slider.
Aha, there you are. So we began the whole thing with the survey, which, you know, this is a very talkative group. And even during the survey, there was a conversation going, even though we were doing our best to get people to focus on just getting the survey complete so that we can move on. But people had things to say. So we did our best to capture everything, even if it wasn't maybe necessarily where we wanted it in the conversation. But ideally, most of it is here represented. So primary medical was highest ranked among the category, service category ranking. And we did a straight ranking instead of a weighted ranking this time because we wanted it to sort of reflect more closely or mirror more closely what the council does. In the past, we had done a weighted ranking. But I think that, you know, if we can compare it apples to apples with what the council's service category prioritization is, I think that's more effective data-wise. I think the main concern here was that there seemed to be a lot of loss around experienced HIV specialists in the city, and feeling like there was a lot of institutional knowledge being lost and not being passed on to newer providers, and that there were just fewer HIV specific doctors out there than there were at one time, which, you know, is somewhat reasonable, I suppose. Dental, unfortunately, was lowest ranked. Cost and ineffective was the biggest issue, followed by feeling like there was just some challenges around sort of even understanding the needs of HIV positive population in relation to dental health and what their challenges might be, specific, you know, to sort of a lot of those aspects that we hear so much around, connected to HIV positive population around mental health and substance use, housing, so forth, and needing to be a little more specific. But a lot of this conversation was about cost. And one person described having a provider actually get them out of the chair and walk them to the sort of the desk to pay for a procedure before continuing on, which seems extreme. Housing, of course, is you know, always an issue. It's not actually a service category because we don't fund housing, but it came up in the conversation, so it's included here. So we framed the conversation. We began the conversation by just sort of having a lot of the general kind of quality of life questions that we ordinarily begin with, but really the focus was to get a sense of how people felt about, you know, they were here specifically. I mean, this was a long-term survivor support group, and we were specifically reaching out to them because of their status as long-term survivors, and we were curious to know what they felt that meant to them. And so, you know, some felt as though they were, you know, had a lot to offer in the way of sort of community leadership and guidance, and their experience. A lot of and others felt very marginalized. Some felt both of those things at once. You know, they could provide knowledge around the system of care and or other things that were within their experience, but they also felt like they were, you know, they were invisible in a lot of respects. And we've heard this one a number of times about, you know, sort of gay community being, you know, very youth oriented, and being a senior in the gay community, being challenging. Being an HIV positive senior in the gay community, even more challenging. One of the other things that I think will probably resonate with some people on the council is when we talk about, we're moving into sort of, a lot of the conversation started to veer towards benefits and accessing services. And also medical provision. And one of the things that was really notable was a lot of people felt like their HIV status was the primary focus of their medical, the service, medical services being provided to them. And it was unclear what parts of that were just aging. And they had concerns that they're the sort of their status as just sort of aging human beings was being lost while focusing on their HIV. And it was not always clear to them which of those things they should be most focused on. They did talk quite a bit about sort of benefits. A lot of these folks had either just aged out of their SSI, and were, you know, sort of move a lot. They were all within a transitional space, either just past it or seeing it coming up right at them around transitioning to what sort of funding stream their monthly check was coming from. I don't believe any of them were working. There might have been one person who was working part time or was at least attempting to go back to work. There not might have been. There was one person. I don't know if he was actually working at the time. Yeah, so that is essentially real broad strokes what the COLA topic or the COLA sort of brought to light for us. Any questions?
Yeah, Dave, thank you for that. I look at some of those answers and it gives me pause for reflection. I realize how, not to make this about me, but how lucky I am. I understand where they're coming from, a lot of their statements. I've felt that way in the past, but it's not like that. Like the UOP section, I'm actually covered by Ryan White and Cal Dental. I don't pay anything at UOP. I've had an excellent experience there. I'm sorry that that's happening to them. But I understand the other part about getting older, going to bed early, the housing issue. You know, I got this thing right now where I believe I have a lot of skills in the community, but I and people ask me about work, but I can't go to work. If I lose my SSI, I can't pay for my housing or my Medi-Cal or my HIV meds. I'm not like looking to live on the dole all my life, but everything that I have is tied into my being on disability. It's not the $972 a month, it's the subsidies. I pay $300 for a studio right now. If I go to work and lose SSI, that becomes $3,125. I can't do that. So I guess I'm just venting, but I feel that I recognize many of those answers that they were giving there. That's, it's hard and there's a lot of fear.
Yeah, I understand. I have a friend who lost his rent subsidy because the income he was earning was more than the rent subsidy allowed. And the thing about programs like this is they literally trap us in poverty. There's no incentive to transition, and it becomes a terrible kind of poverty-driven program that kind of keeps us there.
Just echoing some of the things that I've heard, I feel like, you know, and even, you know, that being said, I feel like DPH has done some things to kind of support, right, by raising the 500% of the FPL requirement. I think it was 400 for everything, but they made it across the board 500 FPL for some of the services. That I think that was beneficial to a lot of folks. There is like this odd gap for being able to qualify for Ryan White Care Services. I think that's the only way. That's the only realm I can like speak, you know, professionally on, you know. But personally, I've experienced that too. It's hard to dig out of that. And you know, to your point, to both of your points, it's a, you know, it does become a matter of healthcare as well. We have a lot of clients who, you know, a parent dies and they get left $20,000 or $30,000, and it could be the end of somebody's Medicare if that happens. You know, like they can't show SSI that they have that money. They've got to figure out what to do with it in a hurry, because next month when it shows up on their statement, Social Security is going to send them a notice and tell them you don't qualify anymore, and then they lose their health care. $20,000 doesn't get you very far. So yeah, it's an unfortunate institutionalization of, you know, to that affects everybody living with HIV, including gainfully employed people doing it. You know, like we're all kind of stuck in it. But I also, there was something that one of the, to bring it back to the report, there was something that kind of landed with me just so unfortunately, and they said stigma has shifted. And I was curious if they had expanded on that, but to me, I took that from, you know, the person feeling stigmatized from being, because of their status, to being stigmatized because of their age and or their status. And that just feels heartbreaking to me, for somebody to just have lived that long and never have felt included. It's an awful feeling, and it's something that hits home for me pretty hard.
Yeah, the only thing that comes up for me around the survey is the lack of information that people receive about their benefits. So benefits management or benefit information is something that's been coming up for a really long time, and something that doesn't get enough funding as far as I'm concerned. Most people wouldn't find themselves in the predicament that they do, like finding surprise billings and stuff, if they knew about the benefits they were eligible for and aren't receiving.
Yeah, and you know, we've done a lot of work over the years trying to make that benefits, make the bureaucracy around benefits less opaque. But it is, you know, I mean, some pessimists might argue that the benefits system is intentionally opaque to function as a type of vetting. You know, you have to be proactive. You have to, you know, I mean, the SSI process, you are almost guaranteed to be rejected first time out as a matter of course. And I think most people know that at this point, that you just, you know, the amount of times that I've personally applied for SSI for clients, helped clients walk through that process and seen rejections for just the tiniest amount of nonsense. Wherein it felt like the follow-up was just sort of like, okay, rubber stamp, as if they were saying, oh, well, you have to do it twice to prove that you really want it. Examples like that you hear all the time. And the fact that so many services are not well advertised or clear and accessible in the internet age, we still can't seem to figure out a way to make, you know, I mean, every other for-profit business has figured out how to make accessing their service super easy, right? That it's all about, like, the UI has been this huge thing over the last 20 years with you know, commerce, internet commerce, and nonprofits and government bodies providing services just can't seem to figure it out. I don't know. Sometimes it feels intentional. I agree. As far as the stigma goes, I think it was a combination, because some were saying, oh, we don't have the stigma of, like, HIV is not a stigma for us now. We don't walk through the world feeling the stigma of being HIV positive like they did at one point in their life. And then others, yes, very much were saying, you know, but also new stigma as seniors. I don't know that it was necessarily the same person's intention to say it moved from one to the other, but it clearly had for some. And some still were fairly distinctly feeling the stigma around being HIV positive. And that had never left them. I mean, I don't know if Derek has any comments on what the group was like itself and wants to share, because he was there, but that was my takeaway from that.
I was going to say anything. I was going to, because I participated in it, I thought I would just listen to the response. But I would agree with a lot of your assessment, and what folks were saying, I think would really resonate with the group as well. I also kind of thought, at least in one case, like the woman that was there, stigma was a different issue, and there was a lot of differences between. There was a lot of similarities, but there was a lot of differences between what was being seen as a gay man's disease compared to what it was for a straight woman with HIV. And I remember that really struck me. And it still does strike me when I think about people. The one comment that you have up there, folks being really concerned about aging out of their Social Security and going on to benefits and suddenly losing a portion of their regular income, sometimes for decades, and suddenly they have to do with less money, and trying to figure out how to deal with that is a pretty frightening situation, particularly as an older person. Richard, I think you were going to say something as well.
Oh, no, the stigma part, when I was in my active addiction and running wild, I really didn't care if someone knew I had HIV. I didn't give a fuck. I didn't care about anything. And as I've gotten well, you know, I still disclose, but I've noticed maybe it's me, my own, I stigmatize myself. It's not as easy to say sometimes for me now in certain company I'm in. I don't hide who I am, but, you know, I'm with different people now, and they don't know. They don't, when they do find out, sometimes I disclose, they're shocked. I'm a heterosexual older guy, and they've known me for a while now, and they didn't know that I had it. And quite frankly, as I get older, like once in a while I can date now. And all of a sudden I have a conversation with a woman about my status, because that eventually dates lead to that. And, you know, I have to have the U equals U conversation, but it's delicate. I'm not being funny here. You know what I mean? It's delicate, and it can cause feelings inside me, like, wow, I do have this still. And no matter how, and people are cool, and, you know, we go through it maturely, but I can register looks in their eyes and the tone maybe of the conversation afterwards. It still carries weight when people hear someone tell that they like you and you tell them, I have HIV. I've had it for 18 years. And just one more quick note, Dave, on the UOP. I don't know how it happened, but my doctor actually, Dr. Egan, years ago, she turned me on. She said, Richard, because I was a mess, I needed like a new mouth from my lifestyle. And she said, you qualify for Ryan White, but you got to stick with it. If you go for this, you got to commit. And they made it pretty streamlined for me. And I've just completed 17 months of dental work. I have a whole new mouth. And I'm not bragging here. I'm grateful as all can be. It didn't cost me a penny. Every 6 months, I submit 3 labs, CD4, platelets, and one other thing to their HR people there. And it requalifies me for the next 6 months under Ryan White and Cal Dental. And all I did was go in there as low income and HIV positive. So, and because as we get older, that's another thing, dental is important. So all these things, that was a really interesting report you gave us, Dave. I can identify with a lot of that. I thought I was always cool with my status, and what do I have to hide? And I don't hide who I am, but it's delicate sometimes now. As I get older and I'm in different company, it's not always table talk conversation still, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think that I think dental still has its challenges for some folks, especially depending on where you go. And, you know, the amount of people I've met over the years who have been fleeced by, a Western dental or something, it's surprising that anyone still uses their services. I mean, some of that was people had been banned from services at UOP and places like that and were forced to go to Western Dental. But also I think it is indicative of long-term survivors who have, you know, a long memory of what that was like, and maybe have a fear of going back to some of those services. Because before Medicare expansion, which was, I guess, what, almost 7 years ago now, 8 years ago, there was not a lot of dental covered under Ryan White. And it was extremely challenging. And it was, you know, you look back at old HCAP reports and it was just dental up and down because it was so hard to access, and the services were really not well geared for the type of people who were using them. So I think maybe in some ways that is most indicative of sort of like their long-term, the long memory of a long-term survivor and how they've seen the ebb and flow of services and availability and funding. And what that looks like. So I'm glad you had a good experience. I really am, because I know a lot of people who have not.
And the syringe access sites and things like that, I'm part of many of them for years now. And San Francisco AIDS Foundation, St. James Infirmary, every week we do them. And I just reflect, I contracted specifically from shared needles. That's bad behavior on my part and poor decisions, but these things save lives now. We just used to pass them around hotel rooms the same. There were no syringe access services and just multitudes of us contracted. And just little clicks like that, syringe access service, harm reduction. I can't imagine the number. I wonder if anyone's ever done a study on the numbers that have probably been missed. People that have been saved, not contracting by these services being available. Because shared needles were an extremely large contributor to HIV contraction. Up until what, 15, 17 years ago, that's when I pulled it. Once again, poor decisions, but there was no syringe access or clean equipment availability. And now it seems commonplace, which is a good thing.
Thanks a lot, Richard. Thanks a lot, Lee. You had something else?
Nope, that is it. So we will, I guess, move on to our next COLA around the SF linkage site. Sounds like there might be some challenges in sort of getting people. Looks like people are a little cagey about collaboration around that, but we'll see what we can do. We'll update you as needed, and we'll move forward with these assessments.
Thanks, David and Kira. Thanks everyone for participating in that discussion. I'm as I said in the comments, like I'm really glad it resonated with folks. A lot of your comments resonated with me as well. And I know it would with the members of the group. With that, we can move on to, we'll end a little bit early. The next meeting date is August the 3rd. And with that, I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everyone, so much.
Take care, everyone.